everyone, and welcome to another podcast of Stick to Wrestling. My name is John McAdam. I am going to be introducing my good friend Sean Goodwin, who is on the line in just a moment. I am going to take about 60 seconds to not stick to wrestling, because back in the news, oh my gosh, is Colin Kaepernick. And I just wanted to share a little story with everyone who's listening. I had a friend named Mike who lived up here in New Hampshire. He lived in Concord, New Hampshire. And Mike was black. And Sean is probably saying, oh man, black guy living in Concord, New Hampshire, this is not going to end well. It doesn't. Mike was a regular guy, married, two kids, transferred up here from Hartford, Connecticut, worked for Lincoln Financial. And the cops wouldn't stop pulling him over. He got pulled over two or three times a month for nothing. I can't remember the last time I got pulled over. I think it was in the 90s, flying home from Montreal in my car. And, you know, Mike was in the car with his wife and kids, and he gets pulled over again. And he says something to the cop, like, you know, hey, why don't you check, see how many times you guys have pulled me over. Maybe you should stop. Guy calls for backup. Next thing you know, he's got five cops, three cop cars, and he called his company, said, hey, get me out of here. So when a player takes a knee, it's a black player or whatever, you don't like what he's doing, this is the America black people have to live in. And I'm just pushing people to be a little bit empathic, because this is a real story that I witnessed. Back to sticking to wrestling, my good friend Sean Goodwin is on the line. Sean, how are you?
Good, John. Well, I see you're ready to go today.
I'm ready to go every day. You know me, man.
So I have to admit,
53. Can you imagine what I was like when I was 23? Good God.
Just a bolt of lightning.
Actually, there are people we both know who knew me when I was 23, so I shouldn't say anything. But anyway.
So last week we started talking about 1985 JCP. It's one thing that we both agree on. It is just one of the truly great years of wrestling from beginning to end for one promotion.
Yeah, for me it was like discovering a great new television show, and you're just starting and you're just getting familiar with the characters and you just love it.
So what was it in retrospect? Because I watch these now. I mean, there was some stuff I watched back then. If I watch it now, it doesn't translate. That does. I've watched it on the network. All those episodes translate. What we figured we would do this week is take a look at some of the cards from back then and see what it was that, you know, you can criticize Dusty for his booking all you want. And every time when you know, the late, great Dusty Rhodes, every time he took a criticism, my answer would have been 1985 JCP.
Yeah, I remember putting on my list when I was putting it out in like 1988 is like, you know, Dusty used to be a great booker and Bill Walton used to be a great basketball player. You know, all good things come to an end. Dusty's being a good booker came to an end, but I'll tell you what, this is like Bill Walton when he was a rookie.
Yeah, this is like the 1977 vintage of Bill.
Let me throw something else in about Dusty's booking. He was great in Florida until the very end where he started. I think his booking really fell off in like 83, 84, maybe even late 82. And it was almost like getting out of Florida and doing his thing in front of a new group of fans and in front of, you know, just having a new crew to work with seemed to re-energize him.
He's like Mike Keenan, the old hockey coach. He would have like a 2-3-4 year just great burst of energy where the team would be really, really good. And then all of a sudden, everyone would just like, I just can't listen to this guy anymore.
The whole thing would fall apart
after like 4 years.
That goes for a lot of baseball managers. Billy Martin, I mean, the first time he yells at you, you're going to listen to him. The 90th time he yells at you, you're going to be like, get out of here, you little shit.
Right. So, I mean, after a while, the crowd gets used to it. They see all the stuff. I mean, and you say 84 in Florida. I think you're being kind. I mean, past 82, I think you're running into a problem. I'd say 83. You're probably running into a problem.
83 was terrible in Florida.
Yeah. I mean, that's when they were relying way too much on the devil gimmick and whatever they called it. The
salt gimmick.
Yeah, I know. They never said it, but I mean, that's basically what it was. So what did make 1985 JCP so great?
It was the talent. It was the booking. And we'll get into this a little bit more. It was the freshness of the talent, I said.
Yes. Yes. I mean, that it was maybe it's just because we were so fed on this one product, the, you know, of WWF, whatever it's, you know, was called at that time, that this was so different. This was like, it was just, I can't even describe how shocking it was. I liked WWF. I liked, you know, Hogan and all that stuff. Not like this, though. This was required. I had to see this every week.
Oh, same here. I mean, I've mentioned this on the show before. I mean, we started getting WTBS in October 1981 when I was 16 years old, and I immediately told my girlfriend, we don't go out until 8:05 anymore. And that lasted until I didn't have the same girlfriend, but that lasted until about 1990.
So let me. So I figured if we can go through, like, well, hopefully we know enough about these guys in retrospect and see what kind of made it great, and what, you know, compare it to, you know, today. You know, what's, why do I like this so much better than I like, you know, what happens today? So, and when did Dusty take over?
Dusty took over, I want to say, summer of 1984. I want to say like July or August is when he started.
Okay, so it took him a while to get some of these guys out of here, to get his people in here. So I'm looking at a card from Raleigh, Dorton Arena. It was a TV taping, and it was from the 2nd. I've sent you this list as well. So yep. Looking at the talent in the card, you have Dusty and Manny are the tag team champions. I've raged enough about that. No reason to go into that again. Over Ron Bass and Black Bart. Okay, Ron Bass is certainly a Dusty guy.
Yeah, and I think at this point it might even be fair to say that Bart was too, because Bart was part of that package that came up from Florida.
Uncle Ivan certainly was, or was he just an institution there? Or did Dusty just realize that this is a great talent?
Probably all of the above. Koloff left the WWF at the very end of 1983. I want to say his last match here was the night Backlund lost the title to Iron Sheik, and he immediately went back into Mid-Atlantic.
Okay, and you have Buzz Tyler and Tully Blanchard. What was, okay, so Dusty was a big Tully. Did he find him in Houston, right? In San Antonio, I mean.
San Antonio, and Tully's the first guy I want to talk about as far as Dusty, at this point, having the ability to scout talent and identify who he could bring in that would make a major difference. If you would have asked me, like, in, I don't know, at the end of 1983, you know, what do you see as Tully Blanchard's upside? I would have said not very high. I think he could be an effective mid-card act someplace, or he could be what he was in San Antonio, a big fish in a small pond. And Dusty identified Tully Blanchard as a main event talent.
Because he pushed him right to the top right away. I mean, he put him with Wahoo against Flair almost immediately, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I remember at the time, you know, they were the After magazines were pushing something they called the Super Feud. It was Ric Flair and Dusty Rhodes against Wahoo McDaniel and Tully Blanchard. And I got to tell you, in 1984, one of those things was not like the others.
Yeah.
I mean, even now, but especially back then.
Okay, let me ask you about the next two names. We have Dick Slater beats superstar Billy Graham by count out. Dick Slater's a Dusty guy. How come Dick didn't stick around?
That is something that I have, I want to say, always wondered, but I have frequently wondered. You know, they had just turned Slater babyface in Mid-Atlantic. I don't think he'd ever been in that role before after having a huge run in 1984 with the U.S. title and the TV title. You know, Slater was a really talented guy. My guess is going to be that in 85, Bill Watts contacted Slater and said, look, you know, I'll let you book if you come over here. And Slater got a big push there, obviously. But even when he was in Mid-Atlantic, I mean, they had him teamed with Buzz Sawyer in a middle-of-the-card tag team that wasn't going anywhere.
Yeah, and Dick was the main event. That was the Dark Journey run in Mid-South, right?
Yes, it was.
Okay. So it must be something like that, because Dick has been a long time Dusty guy. I mean, they've been working together for at this point, 11, 12 years.
Yeah, he got big pushes in Florida, you know, with the Florida title, Southern title. Most of the time when he was in Florida in the late 70s, early 80s, he was the lead heel. He was the lead heel at one point in 1984, too.
And okay, and the other name on this, Dickie beat Superstar Billy Graham. This is the one time they tried to bring back the tie-dye Billy.
It wasn't, not at this point. They actually brought back tie-dye Billy right around maybe October of 85 when they turned him babyface. At
okay.
this point, Superstar Billy Graham, he's in Paul Jones' army, and he's just another guy in the Paul Jones' army, which is kind of sad when you look back at it. But then again, that was his level of talent in 84.
Yeah. And okay, so we have in the mid kind of the mid card beating the Inferno. Who's the Inferno here?
No idea. But this
no
is
idea.
This
and
anything.
Well, I'm guaranteeing you this match lasted 32 seconds because the guy beating him is Magnum TA.
I your predicted time doubled mine. They were having Magnum beat guys right, you know, off the jump with the belly to back suplex as far as his big push.
I criticize it. It worked.
It worked.
Yep. And here's a couple names that kind of this was part of the thing that made this special was because they had a deep bench this year. It wasn't like in the, you know, the WWF heyday when it was a heavy main event and then it would drop off a cliff after that, you know, or like the reverse at WCW where you would have the great undercard. The main events would be terrible.
Yeah.
Here, you have the Barbarian, Sam Houston. Sam got a push.
Sam got a little bit of a push. He was pushed as kind of Dusty and Magnum's, you know, little brother, protege type guy. He was around doing jobs in Georgia on Georgia TV in 84. And it seems like Dusty, at least at first, saw something in Houston that he liked.
And this is also something I liked about JCP, and I also saw this in Memphis, and you never saw this in New York, which was the fact that the jobbers were viable. Or, I'm sorry, the enhancement talent was viable.
Now, you can say jobbers, and yeah, Georgia, when Georgia Championship Wrestling was running, I mean, the matches just stood out because the guys wrestling the stars, yeah, they lost, but they at least fought back.
I mean, the WWF guys were roadkill.
Yeah,
especially in the Hogan era.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the guys on TV who were losing on, like, Superstars of Wrestling, whatever, I mean, you'd sit there and go, oh, my God, how did this guy even get in the dressing room?
Morocco beat a guy while eating a meatball sub.
Yeah,
that's it. Could you ever see that happening in Georgia?
No, you're right, and that's the difference. They didn't do clown stuff in Georgia.
But that really added like a depth to the card, is that you'd watch these two, because you had 2 hours to fill, and you didn't have a lot of 2 hour, at least I didn't see them. Most of the wrestling shows were an hour. This is the rarity. It was a big event. They made us feel like it was being that it was live. It wasn't, but it kind of had that feel to it, like Memphis did.
It did, and one reason is because, as far as I know, most of the your standard WTBS show was filmed that morning.
And I see also on this card the Assassin beating Curtis Harrison. The Assassin had a big run in 84 there, but he's not long here, is he?
No, he had kind of a medium run in 84 when he was with feuding for the most part with Jimmy Valiant, and which isn't the worst thing in the world. I mean, Valiant got a push. Dusty might have looked at him as a guy who was getting, you know, a little heavier, a little older. I mean, he got a super push in Florida as a single in 1981, but you really have to wonder if. I love the guy. I thought he was one of the greatest heels of all time. But, you know, Father Time remains undefeated. And in 85, I kind of wonder if he was a guy you could really push in a national promotion. I'm kind of saying no.
Because, yeah, that 81 feud was against Dusty, right?
Yeah.
Dusty
was the NWA champion.
Wasn't that the El Santo feud?
That was part of it. And if anyone out here ever has a chance to see the entire the assassin is El Santo angle, I mean, it is incredible. You just the guy is so despicable. And I just wanted to jump through the TV and strangle the guy.
Yeah, because this was Austin Idol would steal the angle in Memphis.
Yep.
And basically, I guess Jody found an El Santo mask after one of his trips, and he kind of pushed the idea of that he would walk in as El Santo. He lost a bunch of weight, walk in as El Santo, and then reward Dusty, you know, give Dusty all these awards from, you know, Mexico. And, yeah, you know, it started from there. It was one of the classic angles in Florida history, certainly the 80s.
I remember I got to see it on cable, and I mean it wasn't just that the assassin all of a sudden, you know, started pounding on Dusty, and we found out it was the assassin. He just started getting so nasty. I mean, Dusty's laying there, people are trying to help him, and he's saying, "Pick up that garbage and get it out of here." And I was like, "Oh
yep.
My God, that's harsh."
Yep, you saw the accent come in finally after he said nothing, not to tip it off.
The Idol one was too much. It was almost, yeah, it was comedy, let's face it. Numero uno, brother.
Yeah, it was the Memphis version.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so let's fast forward to March 16th, 1985, and you start to see what Dusty has in mind coming into shape a little bit. We're at Greensboro. Main event is Ric Flair against Wahoo in an Indian strap match, which should have been the main event of Starrcade. But nonetheless,
I heard that somewhere.
Yes, but this would basically be the end of this feud, right?
Yeah, it was kind of the end of Wahoo's push. I think I'm almost positive by March, Wahoo had lost the United States title to Magnum TA, and yeah, Wahoo is basically on his way back to Florida at this point. Also important to note, Ric Flair is 100% babyface at this right now.
Yes, absolutely. He would go through a series of matches with, certainly in North Carolina. And he would have a series of matches with Nikita coming up. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So that's the end of that. Why didn't Wahoo stick around?
I don't know. I think back then it kind of looked like, okay, he had his run and his run was over.
Wow.
And he was back by the end, by the middle of, or towards the end of 85, he was back as a babyface.
Yeah, but he was gone soon after. That was that when they were trying wasn't that when they were, I'm trying to think of it, mixing my years up. Was this the first year of the Crockett Cup, or was it the year after?
Year after, April.
Okay, 19th. I knew they brought him in for that. So, okay, I know the one you're talking about there. So they did bring him back toward the end of the year. But he was pretty much mid-card. And the next match kind of shows you what we start to have in mind here. Dusty beats Tully to win the NWA Mid-Atlantic Television title.
Yeah, and Dusty, you know, this is his first major singles title in the Mid-Atlantic area. And he quickly changed the Mid-Atlantic TV title to the World Television title.
Because, you know, you just have to do that if you're Dusty.
Really quick. Dusty did an interview after this match where he's sitting there with a drink in his hand, ready, with the TV title on his shoulder, ready to hop in his limousine and go party. And either Dusty was buzzed or he was doing a hell of a job faking it. He was definitely speaking and acting like a guy who had a few in him. And it was great.
Dusty beats now Tully had the TV title here for a while.
Yeah, I want to say he had it since summer of 84.
Now, he loses the title here, and they have a little to do after this, but this is pretty much setting up the Tully and Magnum. Because to this day, I remember Tully as a TV champion. He always seemed to have a TV championship when I was, you know, watching. I just always remember him having that belt.
Yeah, he had it more than once.
Yeah, but he's about to start his chase for the U.S. title right about here. Or soon after it.
I kind of see it differently. I'm trying to get this in order. Tully lost a big cage match to Dusty Rhodes where he lost Baby Doll at the Great American Bash. And I'm like, I still have that territory brain going on. You know, I don't really realize that wrestling has changed and guys were now homesteading like Tully. I was shocked, and I don't mean to get ahead of myself. I thought Tully was on his way out. I figured, okay, maybe he's going back to San Antonio or where, you know, to Florida, wherever. No, out of nowhere, he won the United States title for Magnum. It shocked me.
Yeah, it did come out of, it actually did come out of nowhere, because he had to, it was like the deal when Terry Funk won the world title. He had a series of losses. You know, so when Terry did come into town to Florida to, you know, for the title defense, everyone was like, no chance. Because last time I saw him, he lost throughout the town.
It was worse than that. I mean, this was before, right before I became a wrestling fan, but from based on everything I've read, number one, basically no one saw, meaning the fans, really saw Terry as a threat to the NWA title. That's number one. Number two, that match was booked and advertised as Jack versus Dory because they didn't think they would draw with Jack versus Terry.
Yep.
So, you know, so like I said, I wasn't around to experience it as a wrestling fan, but supposedly that was a major shock. So that's a good comparison.
But this is, I mean, this was, Dusty really did a nice job here, where he just had him taking a series of losses, and you could see leading up to it, Tully starting to crack a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, he lost Baby Doll, he lost the cage match, no TV title.
He would start having temper tantrums out on the stage with and Crockett be laughing at him. This is where Crockett was great. When you had someone just loathsome with, like, Tully, and then you put David Crockett with him. That's a match made in, you know, heaven right there. Okay, so still on this card, explain this one to me, because I really have nothing to add to it. Magnum T.A., Don Knoedel, and Sergeant Slaughter beat Ivan, Nikita, and Crusher.
That one looks way out there to me for a couple of reasons. Number one, I mean, Nikita had, you know, we're talking about where was this guy when Dusty brought him in? Well, Nikita didn't exist. He was created by Dusty Rhodes, which is absolutely brilliant. You take Ivan Koloff, who's a legend, and now he has this nephew, this giant bulked up Russian, as the super heel from Russia. And, you know, this is back when the United States and Russia had some serious problems. Just a brilliant creation. Crusher Khrushchev, I mean, I think you're kind of bringing him in a little bit early. I think they should have stuck with just Ivan and Nikita for a while before you make the Russian gang so big like the NWO. But ZF Slaughter, they just brought him in occasionally as an attraction, as someone who had that connection to Don Knoedel.
Huh. Because, well, the Crusher Khrushchev bit, that was started by Bill Watts, right?
Yes, it
in
was.
Mid-South. Okay. Where did he find Nikita from?
He had never wrestled before. He was one of Eddie Sharkey's trainees. One of those guys who, one of that whole Rick Rude, Road Warriors, Kurt Hennig, where all these guys went to high school together. And yeah, Nikita was just a huge guy with a great look that Dusty apparently took one look at and said, you know, if you're willing to shave your head, I'll make you a star. Nikita went for it.
But just to get an idea of the talent, look at the bottom of this card. Okay, this is the first five matches of this card. Dick Slater, Arn Anderson beat Lee Ramsey. Who's Lee Ramsey?
He was a job guy. He was in Georgia and okay. Atlantic.
Manny Fernandez drew Buddy Landell. Oh, yeah.
Let's talk about where Buddy Landell was before all this started. He was, I think we touched on this week, last week. He was in Mid-South Wrestling, and he was managed by J.J. Dillon. And J.J. would get on TV and say, look, you know, I know maybe you watch TV and you saw Buddy Landell lose to this guy, Buddy Landell lose to this other guy. That's the old Buddy Landell. I've got him on the right track. So when you're out there apologizing for a guy's one loss record in another league, and then they turn around and they built him up in 85, and he was due to get a super push at the beginning of 86, and we'll get more into that later.
Yeah, I would love that match, though. Manny Fernandez and Buddy Landell. Sam Houston and Arn Anderson. That's interesting.
Yeah, and I wonder what happened there. I've never seen that match. If they did something where, you know, Manny Fernandez got involved and somehow Sam suckered Anderson. But, I mean, Arn looked like he was getting a huge push from day one. So it's a weird result.
Yeah, wasn't the story that in Mid-South they were trying to figure out who to send over? They needed somebody over at JCP. And the dog said, send Marty. He looks like one of the Andersons.
I'd never heard that story before, but it totally makes sense. I remember watching an episode of Mid-South in 83, and they had this guy, Marty Lundy, on, you know, every couple of weeks. Now he's Arn Anderson, and Bill Watts comes out with an explanation along the lines of, you know, he wasn't ready to let the world know he was an Anderson, but now here he is.
I mean, there was no question in my mind they were related when I saw this. I mean, granted, I was 10, but there was no question. Absolutely not. I mean, they were absolutely related. No question about it. That actually kind of surprised me when I heard they weren't. Because, I mean, they looked a lot.
I was dumb enough to think the Valiant brothers were really brothers, so what do I know?
Well, I guess if you look in the right light, the way they dressed. Speaking of the Valiants, Jimmy Valiant and Black Bart, what did poor Black Bart do to deserve this? Jimmy was crazy over, was completely incapable of putting on a match at this point, a watchable match at this point. Fair enough? Nothing against
seconds.
Jimmy. Yeah, nothing against Jimmy. The fact that he got no one maximized their abilities any better than Jimmy Valiant did.
I cannot, off the top of my head, think of a wrestler who was successful using one gimmick and then completely reinvented himself the way Jimmy Valiant did and was successful doing that. I mean, if Jimmy Valiant had not reinvented himself as the Boogie Woogie Man, I mean, I think his career would have been over rather quickly. He would have been stuck, you know, working Northeast Indies, and that's not fun.
And that was an Ole Anderson innovation, wasn't it?
I don't know either way. I'm inclined to think that Jimmy Valiant came up with it himself. But I mean, I remember when he debuted in Mid-Atlantic, I want to say late 81, early 82, as King James Valiant, as, you know, with Lord Alfred Hayes as his manager, back doing the pretty boy gimmick. You know, that gimmick had kind of the guy dyeing his hair and being, you know, Ric Flair or whoever. I think that gimmick had kind of gotten old, and whoever was smart enough to see that Jimmy Valiant needed something else if he was going to survive in this business, you know, hey, God bless him. They had a good idea.
Because it must have been an oldies book if I'm remembering it, but it was, he told Jimmy, I don't think he imagined it quite the way Jimmy did, but he said, grow out your beard a little bit before you come back.
Huh.
You know, so again, and leave it to Jimmy to, you know, go insanely crazy with it. And there you go. But I said, it makes it sound like I'm criticizing Jimmy Valiant. It wasn't my cup of tea, but I have nothing but, you know, the guy maximized his talent. And if you saw these pops, they were incredible. All you had to do was start the Manhattan Transfer song.
Yeah, I mean, I've been told by more than one source that, you know, all you had to do was put Jimmy Valiant on the main event in some high school gym in, you know, small town in North Carolina, Virginia, wherever, and the people were going to show up. So he had his role.
Yeah, and he did it well. Okay,
and, you know,
so
here's the thing. On this show, we're not afraid to criticize people. I mean, you know, saying Jimmy Valiant was a terrible worker is not exactly putting yourself out there. I mean, it's just a fact. He wasn't a good wrestler, but, you know, being a great in-ring talent isn't all that it takes, and sometimes you don't need that at all.
It isn't that I'm worried about criticizing him. I have no problem criticizing Jimmy Valiant whatsoever. The problem I didn't want to get across is the fact that it worked. Just because I didn't like it, it doesn't mean that a lot of other people, you know, didn't like it either. I just want to kind of make that differentiation, is that just because it wasn't my thing, a lot of other people liked it. Because, I mean, there was no getting around it. Go watch one of those old shows. All you have to hear is start the Manhattan Transfer song start, and the place blows up. And even then, I was 10, I was looking at this like, huh?
If you go back and look at an issue of The Observer – from the Valiant era in JCP. I mean, I don't think there's one kind word that was said about him. But the reality is he had a role and he played it well. And I mean, you can complain about how long someone can complain about how long they did Paul Jones versus Jimmy Valiant. And it was kind of ridiculously long. But I mean, you can't tell me there wasn't interest in the hair match at Starrcade 86.
Oh, absolutely.
And we're like 3 years into the feud now.
Oh, no, he made that feud viable for 4 years. It should have been viable for 6 months.
Yeah.
And he just,
By the time it ended, it was way time for it to be over. But, you know, they kept it interesting as mid-card stuff.
And that's got to be a credit to him. And I know he gets – in Paul Jones' defense in this, they didn't give him a lot to work with. Look at that stable.
Yeah, Paul Jones was one of the worst managers ever. I know he was kept around. I from what I've heard, Dusty was told, give Paul Jones a role because he had been a loyal he'd been loyal to Jim Crockett, and he hurt his back, and he had to retire early. And, you know, Jim Crockett just said, hey, you know, just give him something. And I've also been told that allegedly Paul Jones knew where all of the bodies were buried as far as, you know, in Mid-Atlantic wrestling, and that might have had something to do with it. But I'm inclined to think that, you know, Jim Crockett just gave the guy a break.
So he's getting the Arnold Skolin treatment.
Good analogy.
So, okay, we'll move on to April, and stuff starts to come into form right here. You start to see what Dusty has in mind. Really starts to focus in, because right around here is where the TV starts. This is about, and it was in April of 1985 where they got the slot in WTBS, the 605 slot.
Yes, this is the first show. This is the April 14th, 1985 show. And it is the first show at the Omni since Crockett took over all of the WTBS TV.
Quick question about Atlanta. And looking through a lot of these cards, I noticed more of an emphasis on Atlanta than before. Is that a business decision, or is that Dusty knowing that if he's going to turn Rick heel again, he's got to do it someplace else other than North Carolina?
I never thought of that before. I'm thinking they emphasized Atlanta more because they had that powerful television station in Atlanta where they were having 3 hours, 4 hours of wrestling every week. So, you know, you want to use that to draw a crowd.
Was Dusty also thinking along the lines of, I remember Bill Watts said this when he took over WCW, that he wanted to make the Omni the MSG of the South for wrestling?
I'd never heard that, but it totally makes sense. I mean, you know, the WWF, they had their flagship show, WOR,
yeah,
which was on cable, and MSG was, you know, the center of everything. You know, we were talking about WWF a couple of weeks ago, and someone on the Stick to Wrestling Facebook page, which I have once again failed to mention, but, you know, join our page if you like the show. They were like, you know, yeah, people act like, you know, nothing outside of Madison Square Garden existed. Pittsburgh didn't exist. Baltimore didn't exist. It's because, A, that's where the cable show was based out of, and B, that's where the aftermags were based out of. And, yeah, the promotion, you know, did make Madison Square Garden more special than Pittsburgh or Boston.
They booked everything in 9-week cycles.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically three Madison Square Garden cards. You know, I mean, yeah. And if you were great, and I think it happened 2-3 times, something like that, you get a fourth.
It happened once, Pat Patterson.
Oh, it happened just once? Okay. So
yeah, and it wasn't even supposed to happen. They were going to bring in Roddy Piper for a two-match series with Backlund, and Vince Sr. thought Piper was too small, so they brought in Sweet Hansen for one match, and they extended Patterson from a 3-match series to a 4-match series.
Yes, I remember having a tirade about that before. So we go to the April 14th show, and you have Ron Garvin beating Bob Roop. Bob Roop.
Yeah, and this is an interesting match because it's almost like the Georgia it's not almost like the Georgia promotion had been taken over by Mid-Atlantic, and anytime any company gets taken over, you know there are going to be radical changes coming quickly, and you're not going to be able to recognize your workplace within a year or two. And I think both Ron Garvin and Bob Roop had to know that they might not have jobs in this promotion for very much longer. And in Bob Roop's case, he did not. And I think it was just a numbers game, to be honest with you. And Ron Garvin stuck around for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
He made it work.
How was Bob's relationship with Dusty?
I don't know. I have no reason to. No, you know what? I was about to say I have no reason to think they didn't have a good relationship. But Bob Roop had a big push in Florida in the 70s, like 76, 77, and he never went back there. Like, it almost surprised me that they never brought either Orton or Roop back after they got their start in Florida. Maybe it had to do with the fact that they were both in ICW. I mean, maybe the ICW thing was coming to haunt Roop in 1985. Who knows?
Okay, and let's see. We have Tully Blanchard beat the Italian Stallion. Here's an interesting match. Magnum TA beat Buddy Landell.
Now, just to show you, backing up a little bit, how bad Ole's promotion was before Crockett took over, Italian Stallion was getting a push in Ole's promotion. But anyway, Magnum and Buddy, you know, old pals from Bill Watts Mid-South Wrestling, and it seems a little early for Budrow to be doing the job, but then again, someone has to.
Okay, the next matchup is, this is just kind of your standard, what you would have as a main event for the old 605 show. A match of kind of, sort of, this quality. Dusty Rhodes, Jimmy Valiant, and Buzz Sawyer beat Ivan, Nikita, and Crusher.
The only thing missing, and you're right, that is exactly the kind of main event you would see on WTBS. The only thing missing from that match is the guy you look at, that sixth guy, where you're like, okay, he's doing the job. And they only had that guy, but you're right. And Buzz Sawyer is another guy who was in Ole's Georgia promotion that got absorbed in Mid-Atlantic, and he had to be asking himself, okay, how much longer am I going to be around? And the answer was not much longer.
What was the deal with Buzz? I mean, had he lost that much that he wasn't even viable to them anymore?
No, I think part of it, for one, I mean, Buzz got a huge push in Georgia in 1983, and a lot of people don't like it when I say this. I think he got over-pushed. I don't think there's any way you can build around Buzz Sawyer the way Georgia did in 1983. We need to have a whole show of me just bagging on 1983 Georgia so I can lose all of our listeners. But anyway, Buzz was a guy who just wasn't – I thought he was over-pushed, but at this point he might have been under-pushed, and he also may – I mean, they spent all of 83 building him up to turn him, and I think the reality is his natural role is as a heel. I don't think Buzz is a very good babyface.
No, not at all. It would have seemed that Dick Slater and Buzz Sawyer as a tag team would have made a nice little heel tag team.
Yeah, and they, you know, showed up in Mid-South together, and they were a very effective faction, I thought.
Okay. Now, the next match, I just see the listing. I can already tell you exactly what the match is. Thunderbolt Patterson and Manny Fernandez beat Ole Anderson and Arn Anderson by DQ. Is this the match where Thunderbolt is about to be splashed with a chair on him and Manny got in the way and got himself injured? And that was the disqualification.
Oh, I bet it was. I bet it was because they probably had a camera there and they were running the angle. And that I have to think yes. I mean, and Thunderbolt, you know, I don't want to bag on the guy too much, but my God, you look at this card and who really sticks out as the guy who does not belong here? It's Thunderbolt Patterson.
Oh, absolutely. The basic angle here was the fact that Thunderbolt and Ole had split, but they were still the national tag team champions at the time. Now, this is something that this angle has been done before. It's been done in ECW with Candido and Storm. It can and can't. This time it worked because they didn't do it too long.
No, they have one guy with one belt and the other guy with the other belt, and they have split up and they now hate each other. This is going to sound a little bit off, but I remember watching this. And, you know, Ole's got his belt, and Arn is saying, hey, I'm going to be part of the National Tag Team Champions. And Manny's out there talking about, no, I'm going to be that. And it's okay for Arn to do that because he's a heel. But I'm like, Manny, you haven't earned that title. You should be saying, no, this should be in a tournament, and having Thunderbolt saying, no, Manny, I need someone. Come on. Manny says, all right. You know, Manny, at the time, I was just like, man, this guy's sort of entitled, isn't he?
No, true. And in the main event, when did Hayes get here? The main event is Ric Flair beat Michael Hayes.
If I recall correctly, Hayes made a couple of tapings right before Ole's show went off TV. And then he was prominently featured on the first few episodes of Georgia Championship, World Championship Wrestling after Crockett took over. So it looks like he would have been on either one or two shows. But, I mean, he had a verbal confrontation with Flair on one of the shows. And plus, you know, I mean, Hayes was well-known in Georgia. He had been there, obviously, in 80, 81, 82. Then he came back for a little while in 84. And then he was on Ole's show. So, I mean, I think it's actually a good main event for Atlanta at this time.
Oh, absolutely. I didn't realize he was there yet.
No, he, like I said, I could be wrong. He was definitely on Ole's show. And I think it was right beforehand. And I know he was, you know, got a lot of airtime on the first couple of shows after Dusty and Crockett took over.
Okay, let's move into May 12th. And the first match I see is Dusty Rhodes and Dick Slater beat Ivan Nikolov and Nikita Koloff in the angle that went absolutely nowhere. This seems to be – okay, so even the angles that didn't work were entertaining. Now, I believe this angle was the thing with the gorilla costume, right?
Yes, they had – it was so silly and it's so stupid – and I will honestly tell you that at the time, it made me laugh. They had someone, Dusty brought out a gorilla in a cage because this was going to be his counter to that big gorilla Nikita Koloff. And it was obviously, you know, a guy in a gorilla suit, but you have Nikita looking at it and he can't figure out what's going on. Like, he doesn't know what a gorilla is, so maybe this thing's real. And the whole thing was just comical and entertaining. And then Dick Slater finally reveals himself as the guy in the gorilla suit. He's complaining that it was too hot in the gorilla suit under the lights. It was so dumb, but it made me laugh.
Anybody else other than Dickie Slater or maybe Murdoch? And this doesn't work.
You know what? The more I'm thinking about this, the more you're right. And Slater he hadn't really been featured in Georgia for a while, though. He was around for a little while. I think he made a special appearance at the Omni in 83. And that I think he defended the United States title against Pez Whatley. I'm going back a ways here, obviously. And that's really it. He hadn't been around since like 80 or 81, I want to say. Maybe.
But he was a big star back then, though.
He was. He's still a big star now. I mean, he's coming off, you know, like I said earlier, a run with the United States title in Crockett.
Oh, but I mean in Georgia. He was a big star in the late 70s. He had a feud with Wrestling 2, I think.
He had a huge feud with Wrestling 2, and he was the Georgia heavyweight champion.
So, yeah, so I'm just saying, he had been gone for a few years for any significant role, but when he was there, it was a big, big role.
Yeah.
And the next match is, I have no recollection of this. This must have been a non-title match of some kind, because he says Manny and Thunderbolt beat Ole and Arn, and Manny and Thunderbolt never had the title. Ole and Arn were the last national champions, I believe.
Yeah, it might have been a DQ or a non-title match, or maybe they just hadn't settled the situation with the belts yet.
Okay, we have Jimmy Valiant in a no contest with Abdul the Butcher. This was Paul Jones bringing in his crew to try to take out Jimmy.
Yeah, I may have mentioned this last week. I always thought Abdul the Butcher was underpushed in Mid-Atlantic. He was always like this guy that Roddy Piper or Paul Jones or Tully Blanchard was bringing in. as an assassin. I thought, you know, had he been willing to stay, and I know that's a huge if, but you could have done a lot with Abdullah.
I think you have the same problem with Abdullah that you have. It's actually the same management that you would have with Brody.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they were both legitimately managed by Gary Hart. And, you know, Gary has no problem pulling this guy out in a minute.
I know Gary Hart and Abdullah were very much connected. I had no idea Gary Hart actually managed Bruiser Brody, like real life managed him.
I believe he did, yeah. Pretty much most of the guys that Gary managed, like the guys you always saw him with, he actually managed. I didn't mean like somebody who they threw him in with, like Kabuki. He was actually Kabuki's manager.
Yes, that I knew. He was actually, what's his name, Great Muta's manager, and that turned into a problem because if you have one performer legitimately managing another performer, I mean, I want to say it's a conflict of interest to either Gary Hart or the Great Muta, but it's definitely a conflict when it comes to the company.
Yeah. I do remember one story when Gary's management of Brody and Abdullah came in, because both Abdullah and Brody said they wanted to do a cage match against each other. And I think I've told this story before, but Gary said, okay, let's see how long it takes to figure out what the problem is here. The problem is, of course, one of them has to do a job. So they're like, well, we'll just, oh, this would have been, it was in his book. It was in Atlanta. It was probably in like the late 70s, early 80s, maybe something like that.
Okay.
But there was a cage match between, and I guess they were both in there, and they're like, well, why don't we just have a draw? He's like, you can't have a draw in a cage match. So finally, I think
they did a cage match in World Class in 86, and Brody lost the cage match.
That must have been it. And the reason Brody lost was he just got sick of the match. They got like 20 minutes into it, he's like, okay, I give up. I can't take it anymore.
Oh, man.
He decided to take the pinfall. Okay, one other guy I noticed here. Bagdon TA beat John Tatum.
Yeah, Tatum came in, and he was on Mid-Atlantic television. I don't remember him ever being on Atlanta television, although I might be mistaken. But he got kind of an undercard push, similar to, let's say, Sam Houston or Italian Stallion. And obviously, he didn't last long. Tatum was an unknown at this point. He was about to, you know what? Oh, man, now I just totally opened up a can of worms. This is probably right around the time he met Missy Hyatt, and she became his girlfriend, and he kind of said, you know, chopped her around as far as, you know, hey, I got this act with my girlfriend Missy, and World Class bought it.
Huh. Really?
I mean, he worked in Atlanta, not in the wrestling business, and this had to be where they, right around the time they hooked up.
Would Dusty have seen her?
I cannot imagine John Tatum being in the promotion and not introducing Dusty to Missy and saying, you know, hey, I've got this idea.
Yeah.
And Dusty probably, the more I think about it, he probably didn't want to do it because he already had Baby Doll on his radar as far as the girl he was going to push.
True. And she was, I always thought she was a great performer. I mean, say what you want, but I always thought as a performer, for what her job was, Baby Doll meaning, she was great at it, at least in this era.
I was going to say, I wasn't sure who you were talking about, Baby Doll or Missy, because those comments would have been applicable to either one, in my opinion. Missy was great early in her career.
Well, it's true. That is true. One match here that I kind of glossed over, and I shouldn't, because it was one of my favorite matches of the era. I don't mean this one particular, but oh, this one was great. But anytime these two got in the ring, and it would have been... They should have done more with these two. Tully Blanchard and Ronnie Garvin.
Yeah, Tully, you know, beats Ronnie Garvin, and I'm kind of looking at this at the time as, you know, okay, you know, Ronnie Garvin came in 83, you know, as someone who hadn't been in the mainstream in a long, long time. Once again, we're talking about the ICW thing. Well, that's because Ole brought in a bunch of ICW guys in 83. And he won the TV title, but to me, he never came across as like a real star. You know, just kind of a, nothing wrong with this, a middle of the card journeyman. And to me, at the, this time in 85, I'm looking at it as, you know, hey, this is his role.
I liked him from the beginning. And the reason I liked him was because it was the same reason you like Harley. He made you believe. The promos didn't make you believe. He made you believe in the ring.
Yeah,
I mean, because that was...
I grew to like him. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. And especially against Tully, because God bless Tully. Tully must have had layers of skin taken off of him by Garvin. Because he got the crap beaten out of him.
Yeah, Ron Garvin wrestled one match. If you didn't like it, don't wrestle Ron Garvin.
Oh, and Tully just, God bless his soul, he just took it. I mean, their matches, I really wish they did something with them over, like, the TV belt or something like that. Because that, they just had, there was two guys who were just incapable of having a bad match.
Well, I mean, they did have a feud for the national title in 86.
Yeah, I guess.
So we got that, we got that cool match.
Yeah. That's the match I'm thinking of. But I remember them in 85, too, a couple times, because Ronnie started getting into, like, the good guy click with Magnum and Dusty them. Go ahead.
No, they did a match on WTBS where Ronnie was defending the national title against Black Bart, and Tully interfered and cost Garvin that title. So that's probably right. I want to say it's right around this time, and I bet that match from the Omni took place after the angle where Tully and Baby Doll basically cost Garvin the title.
Now, who were the guys in Georgia from this era? Who were the guys from Georgia that Dusty was like, okay, you were my guys. I'm going with you guys. The rest of you are out of here. Now, obviously, but we interrupted you. Buzz Sawyer's out. Well, he will be soon.
They couldn't get Tommy Rich out of there quick enough. And that one surprised me until I found out that, you know, Tommy and Dusty, Tommy, for whatever reason, did not like Crockett and did not like Dusty. Like, hated him. So I was surprised at that one, but in 1985, I was surprised that, you know, Tommy was gone, and I'm reading about him in the magazines now wrestling in Alabama, but, you know, now I kind of found out what the story was, like, you know, 25 years ago.
So he would be out. How about Jake Roberts? Where was Jake at this point?
Okay, Jake had left Georgia. I want to say mid-84, maybe towards September, and wound up in World Class. He was in World Class for the rest of the year. Then early 85, he shows up in Mid-South, and he was still in Mid-South at this point. As a matter of fact, he'd still be in Mid-South for another year.
Was there any discussion to bring in Jake in?
Not that I'm aware of. And Jake... As you're aware, they had 6 episodes of Mid-South Wrestling on right before this, and Jake just was amazing. He had really honed his craft to the point where you could see this guy, you know, okay, he's still a little thin upper body-wise, but, you know, he had the makings of a star, and, I mean, I can tell you right now, if I were Dusty Rhodes at this moment in 1985, I would have let Jake know that, hey, you know, hey, we'd love to have you over here.
Yeah, because, well, he had a great little feud with Garvin, didn't he, in Georgia?
Yes, it wasn't really a little feud. The feud went on way too long.
Yeah.
But it was over the TV title, and it was I'm going back away from our subject matter a little bit, but they did this ridiculous angle that stands up to no scrutiny, where Ronnie Garvin wants a shot at Jake Roberts' TV title, and Paul Ellering says, you know, okay, it's going to cost you $35,000. And Ronnie Garvin, I don't have $35,000. And Paul Ellering tells him to sell his house. So Garvin sells his house. Jake, they have the match. Jake retains the title, and Jake shows up on TV with this fur coat and all kinds of, like, sparkles in his hair. I thought it was stupid, but it was hilarious. Ron Garvin had to sell his house. He lost the match so that Jake Roberts could have a mink coat.
And he was a Dusty guy, wasn't he? Because Dusty's pushed him before.
Jake?
Yeah.
Jake got his first real push under Dusty Rhodes in Florida in, like, fall. It started fall of 82 when he put Jake under Kevin Sullivan.
Yeah, he was a Santa Claus in the cage.
Yeah, exactly. He was kind of Sullivan's underling, and yeah, he was the Santa Claus that night in Christmas Night 82 when Dusty lost the Loser Leave Town match to Kevin Sullivan. So yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if he's quote-unquote a Dusty guy or if Jake just, you know, I mean, let's face it, you know, JCP, you made a lot of money, but you made a lot of money in Mid-South too. And I know Jake was the booker at one point in 85, so maybe that's, you know, one big reason why he didn't want to leave.
How much of a competition? How much of competition was Mid-South in 85?
I mean, none really, and I'll tell you why. For all of the, I mean, utmost respect I have for Bill Watts as a wrestling promoter, he just got in late, too late on the game when it came to syndication, and he never got on cable. And, you know, I mean, we've talked about it more than once. I mean, what if Bill Watts gets this WTBS cable spot? But he didn't. You know, he didn't get on any of the other cable networks. He was, you know, syndication was still a huge deal in the mid-80s. Listeners, don't let anyone fool you. It was not. Actually, syndication at this point was more important than cable. That would soon change. But, you know, Watts never really got to the finish line when it came to national syndication either. So, you know, he's not a threat because he's not getting his product out there in front of, you know, millions and millions of eyeballs like Crockett was at this point, like Vince had been for over a year.
Okay, we have time to go over one more card in June. This takes us to the midway point, and you start off with, Kevin Sullivan and Rocky King.
Yeah, Sullivan, they brought in he seemed to just come and go. He was not doing the satanic guy gimmick, and he just didn't last very long here for whatever reason. But he was definitely brought in. Now, he wasn't part of... You know, he wasn't part of the Mid-Atlantic crew. He wasn't part of Ole's old Georgia crew. He was working Florida like late 84, early 85. So, but yeah, he did not last long here.
And okay, Pez Watley and Italian Stallion beat Tommy Lane and Mike Davis. By the way, this card is from June 23rd, 1985. It's in Atlanta. Tommy Lane and Mike Davis, the RPMs.
The Rock and Roll RPMs. The guys were decent workers, but I am just surprised that they would let them go out there with that gimmick, especially if they had any idea that the Rock and Roll Express were going to be there soon.
Did they have the gimmick then?
They did. They initially did the gimmick. Those two were part of the leftovers of Ole's old late 84, early 85 crew.
Okay, I didn't think the RPM gimmick came up until Texas. Okay, I didn't know they had it this early.
They debuted it. I think they started in either Puerto Rico or Southwest in like the middle of 84 with this kind of bizarre heel. I'm not even sure if they weren't heels in Puerto Rico, but they were heels here. And it's Mike Davis and, you know, Tommy Lane. They look like what they were, a couple of, you know, journeyman, undercard pro wrestlers, and a bottle of dye and a couple of bandanas not going to solve that problem for you.
Okay, Thunderbolt beats Bob Roop. Both are pretty much out the door at this point.
You know what? I looked at this match, and I was like, wow, I'm surprised they're still around June 23rd, 1985. But one thing, let me throw this in really quick.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Dusty wouldn't do it because of ego issues, but did you ever see Mike Davis as the Dream in Florida, like summer of 84?
Yep.
It is amazing. I will never understand why Dusty did not bring that character back. First of all, why it didn't get a bigger push in Florida.
What do you think?
So short-lived. We all know why, but why put that aside and have some fun with it and put it on WTBS and, you know, bring him in with Sullivan or some other whack job that, you know, I mean, I remember Kevin, you know, bringing it up, saying, you know, I'm going to be out here teaming with the American Dream. It's coming. And then Mike Davis shows up with this big X on his forehead, talking, you know, with his hair dyed blonde, just like Dusty Rhodes, and doing a dead-on Dusty impersonation.
It was like hearing Andy.
It out. they did it after Dusty left Florida. Dusty didn't
leave
Florida. Dusty was gone. So it was like August of 80. But I still don't know why they didn't push it. Maybe Dusty called and said, I don't like it, and they stopped.
He's got thin skin, that's why. And that's probably exactly what happened, hoping they can bring him back at some point. But the thing with the if you haven't seen the Mike Davis impersonation, it's like Andy Kaufman doing Elvis. You look at it like, where did that come from? It is spot on. It is done by a guy who's clearly been watching Dusty Rhodes up close for a long time.
Yeah. And, you know, and someone that, you know, obviously he's got to be a fan of Dusty if he's working so hard on this, you know, doing this impersonation. It was great.
Oh, spot on. Black Bart beats the American Starship Eagle.
Dan Spivey,
early incarnation. Jimmy Valiant. Okay, Billy Graham is about to head out here, isn't he?
No, Billy Graham didn't leave until like the beginning of 86. They kept him around as just,
I thought there was like a gap here.
No, he was around until Vince saw, you know, he turned babyface, he did the tie-dye thing, and then Vince saw that and he invited him back.
Okay. Because I thought there was a gap here in the summer where he was gone for some reason, and the very short-lived, okay, now they put Sawyer with Slater. Is that pretty much the kiss of death? Because you know Slater's out of there because he's main eventing in Mid-South.
I don't know if he was in Mid-South yet, but what they did an angle where Arn Anderson comes out and he's picking on Brett Sawyer, and Ole's like, hey, where's your big brother? And Brett's like, he's in the shower. And Arn's like, oh, he's in the shower. And he just turns around and beats the crap out of Brett. And I don't know how they did this, but it looked like Arn kicked him in the head as hard as he could. It was just a brutal-looking kick. And you see Buzz run out, like, all covered in soap and whatever. And it was campy fun at the time. And then they put Buzz with Dick Slater. And it totally made Brett look like a guy who could not fight his own battles. And there was no reason for that. You could have had an effective Buzz Sawyer and Brett Sawyer tag team, especially given the fact that, you know, Brett had just been the national heavyweight champion, you know, a little over a year ago. I thought Brett was pushable.
Maybe this is why Dickie left. He put him with Buzz. He's like, no, I'm not doing this.
No, Dickie was just as crazy, not just as crazy as Buzz, but crazy enough to handle Buzz.
Okay. And, okay, now you have the Ole and Arn team against them. I love these guys. I mean, I didn't at the time. I hated their guts. But that's why I love these guys. They're such a hateable team.
They were, and the thing was, Arn Anderson in 1985 was such a thing to behold, because in 83, I thought Arn Anderson was boring, he sucked, he couldn't do an interview. And that's the truth. In 84, he was in Continental, and you saw him getting better. You saw his interviews getting better. You saw him just gaining a presence on the television set. Now in 85, you are starting to see this guy blossom into a star. And he was a star.
No, absolutely at this point. And then speaking of stars, in the main event, Magnum TA. Is this his first shot at the big time here?
I mean, in a general sense, yes. One of the first things they did on WTBS, this must have been the first Atlanta match, one of the first things they did was they had Magnum get on TV, and he got on TV, and they did an angle where Ric Flair presented him a suit, so he doesn't have to run around in those silly blue jeans anymore, and that suit was just screaming, no, you know what's going to happen to me, don't do this, and well, Magnum did it. He ripped up the suit on TV, and now these two are feuding.
Rick is so awesome at this point. So Magnum gets a DQ win on Flair. Rick is basically a massive heel or a massive face, just depending on who he's in there against.
And he was really good at this time at being a tweener. Like, you're right. He was, you know, he was a heel against Magnum, but he wasn't a really hateable heel in my opinion. You know, he's just, you know, out there goofing on Magnum, and Magnum goes out and makes him look silly and rips up the suit. And I thought he did a good job in that role, and obviously I think he should have stayed in that role.
So I think we're running a little bit out of time a bit right now. We've gotten to the Great American Bash, and the Starrcade card's about to start to come together.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about the second half of 1985 this week. I mean, this flies by, man. We're talking about a lot of fun stuff, and the day is going to come when we do 1986, and I think Sean and I are both going to be, you know, oh, this is so great, and this happened, and this happened, and our tones are going to change a little bit when we talk about 1987. We'll do that eventually. And we're just going to be spitting chips when it comes to 1988, because that's when all of the really bad mistakes were made. But this podcast has been a presentation of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, and I thank everyone for listening, and we will see you next week. Have a good one.